Thanks for listening to the Scottish Housing Podcast. You can find out more about the presenters by going to scottishhousingpod.com, and you can also follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok and Facebook. Just look up at Scottish Housing Pod.
The Scottish Housing Podcast is brought to you in partnership with Indigo Square, 2010 Consultancy, and the Right Business Center.
So, we've only just started doing the podcast, and since we started doing these podcasts, so we've recorded with a couple of political people ready to go out, and the world has changed. So I'm the property guy, Stephen, you're the politician. So for the listeners and viewers, explain what's going on in Scottish, in the last 2 weeks in Scottish governmental political circles.
Well, first of all, I'm not the podcast guy. You are. The one thing I have learned is that, you know, nobody did all that pre-recording with politicians or political people, and the world has changed dramatically. So much of the content's out of date. But there you are.
Although I have to say,
the show business.
Yeah, exactly. But I have to say, from looking back at some of the stuff we've recorded, that so for people listening, don't be put off by future content is going to be out of date, because there is still a relevance.
Absolutely. Yeah. I start with a joke to lighten the mood and ease my mind into thinking politically again. And I suppose I do give a lot of political advice to clients, but I am a recovering politician. So I have to ease my mind, because I don't necessarily want to always think politics the way I used to. But look, a seismic moment is a description used in politics all the time. Turn on Sky News, turn on News 24. Every time there's a big event, it's seismic, isn't it? I don't know how many seismic results there were in the local election results in England on Thursday. There were, but, you know, it's just seismic. And there's been several seismic moments for the SNP in the last 20 years. They went from being a movement, a party almost of protest, of campaigning, to a party of government. And that's what devolution enabled, with our parliament elected by proportional representation. And that in itself, of course, is a bearing on what's happened here. But this is seismic because this is certainly the first time in living memory, in any of our political living memory, that the SNP establishment has removed the First Minister. That's what happened. Or the leader.
Yeah.
Right. There was a movement because there was a realisation. I am speculating, of course, but it's my observations that two or three key things. One, some decades, if at all, since there was such disunity within the SNP, and certainly for those of us that have observed and worked with, indeed, the SNP since they won power, in those elections, that seismic, I'll use the word, 2007 Scottish election result, everyone, particularly post-independence, have been absolutely in admiration, even if it's private admiration, of their level of discipline and unity. Mm-hmm. And there is no question that that was breaking. Everybody thinks it's because of the Green Coalition, and there's no doubt that was part of it. But let's be honest, part of it was also the leadership of Hamza. And, you know, it's always horrible to say that about someone. I've had plenty of comments about my leadership at the City Council in Glasgow. But the reality was that he wasn't able to fill the boots. Now, could he have ever followed Nicola Sturgeon's boots? You know, we love football. Alex Ferguson leaves Man U.
Yeah, and then you've got...
And thirdly, and here's the big thing. Here's the real thing that's going on, in my view. There is now a resurgent Labour Party, because the Labour Party looks credible at United Kingdom level, mm-hmm. to winning power. And that's actually what's putting the greatest pressure on the SNP. And my own take is that's really why Hamza was removed.
So then two things that come to mind out of that. As someone who I've always had an interest in politics, I know people from different parties, so I like to, you know, think that you can see lots of sides of it. One is, so you mentioned the SNP were a party of party of process, maybe too strong a word of it, but they were a movement towards independence rather than a party of power when we were growing up.
Look, and this is a really important point if we're going to have a bit of a political conversation that is less at this stage about housing. They were a party of interest. They were a party that could win by-elections at a time that support for independence would maybe average at around 25%. Yep. Now, here's the thing. Support for independence has not shifted since 2014. So it's been the odd poll that gets it at 55%, the odd poll that gets it at 42%, medium of average, 50%, and still 50%, despite the fact the SNP is now going further and further down the polls to as low in some as 30, but say on average 35%. You see the point I'm making? Independence is up here, support for the SNP is much further down, the complete opposite. Mm-hmm. Where the SNP was by the time it came to power in 2007. So the strategic objective of the SNP, who are the lead party in the independence movement, has been achieved in the sense that you've got this really solid support for independence that ain't shifting, even though people might be saying, we need to get a Labour government in, we need to get these Tories out. Support for independence has changed. Maybe a debate at another time on how it pertains to housing, but we could make that link as this is a long-term problem for the Labour Party. In fact, it might be a medium-term problem once, inevitably, the UK Labour government that's going to be elected becomes unpopular or goes through midterm blues. So, you know, politics in Scotland is going to continue to be fascinating. But for those of us that are really interested in the future of housing and all the aspects we've discussed, the issue of housing is so politically important, it's so economically important, but, you know, more importantly, it's so basically important as a human right to people that we can't allow all this political flux.
Well,
and by the way, housing was a factor as well. Because the straw that broke the camel's back for many people was that cut in the affordable housing budget. When I speak to SNP councillors and friends of mine and SNP members, I'm sure this must apply to MSPs, the cut in the affordable housing budget and the housing bill was just the whole thing's a dog's breakfast.
So, on that, so one of my thoughts sort of looking back is one of the challenges for the SNP is they came from that position of a party behind a movement and a concept, independence, where they had the odd high profile MP winning a by-election, you know, obviously thinking about Govan and things like that. So they had just three or four high profile people when you and I were growing up. Suddenly, there's a massive transformation happens in a really short period of time where they go to becoming the party of government. So one of the challenges of that is if you've got four or five really good people and the rest are just, without sounding patronising, the masses who do the door knocking and the campaigning, firstly, you've got to transform that into having 20, 30 really good, capable people. And my perception is one of the challenges you talk about, people being disaffected with Hamza Yousaf. One of my perceptions was one of the challenges is that they just had, they persisted with that core three or four really good people. And then when those three or four really good people have come to the end of their time, it's not been great what's fed through. So that's number one. Number two, from what you just described as well, that they moved to being a party of government and for the first time the party has removed a leader. They've acted like the Tory party. Because the Tory party is famous for being, we will do whatever it takes to stay in power.
I'll take the first, you know, to your first point, no political party is good at succession planning.
Yeah,
because everybody thinks they should be leader. Not everybody wants to be leader, but everybody thinks they're capable of being leader and, you know, all the manoeuvring and what you see in the thick of it and House of Cards. That means all true. That's how people behave, you know. And for lots of people, it's become, you know, I speak to younger people in politics and sometimes I get quite dismayed every time I'm manoeuvring in this and you think, what are you actually doing in your ward? But anyway, that's what happens when you become your father, you know, in your 50s and you realise, not in my day. The second point is an important point. They have behaved like the Tory party. The Labour party's never been good at removing failing leaders. Now, you wouldn't, you and I now predominantly work in you work always in the private sector. I know predominantly in the private sector. Commerce and business wouldn't put up with that. If a leader's failing, they've got to go. It doesn't mean you're unkind to them. You always have an exit plan, but they've got to go. So yes, it is remarkable. The Tory party are good at it. And the SNP are good at it. And, you know, look, people shouldn't write off how significant or how seismic this decision of whoever it was in the establishment, the grey kilts, whatever, to remove a leader. Because I suspect what's happening is that the SNP establishment, whoever these people are not planning for this year, next year, maybe in some ways not even for the next Holyrood election, but they're making a decision about their eye will be on when their opportunity will be again, because they do only have one strategic purpose, which is independence. And the next opportunity for that comes when there's an unpopular UK Labour government. Mm-hmm. What has stopped independence in its tracks just now is a combination of three things, in my view. One, the possibility of a UK Labour government. Secondly, the cost of living crisis and the economic uncertainty. So, you know, lots of my family and friends is about independence are still supporting it, but they understand this would not be the time to begin to go down that road. And thirdly, it's been the perceived incompetence of the SNP government since Nicola left, and others would argue it was while she was there, but you know, mainly the perception has been since she left, you have to have competent government as well. And my own view, and I worked with him very closely when I was leader of Glasgow City Council, I do hold him, you know, a huge respect for him, is that whilst people do have criticism of his time at education and other things, I mean, I think he is a competent individual and will run a competent government. But the SNP, in my view, are planning for some time ahead at the moment. That's what this decision was about.
So on that, and I'm going to get, for the listeners who think, yeah, all very good, you said there was going to, this was a podcast about housing, and I'm going to get to housing in a minute, is my perception, and Alex Hammond articulated this, my perception when the SNP came to power was that Alex Salmond's view was very simple. Don't muck it up. Turn up, do the day job, do it competently, and then the public, a chunk of the public will move with us to the position of, actually, it's not going to be a basket case country if we go independent. You might not get people moving to a position of enthusiasm about independence, but if you've got that core 20-30% massively in favour of it, I always felt his attitude was, if you could then get another third of people who say it wouldn't be the end of the world, you'll get there on independence. And the first sort of half, two-thirds of the SNP being in power was, don't rock the boat. Don't do any policies.
So it was don't rock the boat, but it was also about competent government.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most churlish, the most anti-SNP people could argue that neither Alex Salmond or Nicola Sturgeon's governments were incompetent. They weren't. You know, government's hard at local or national level. Not everybody will be happy all of the time, but both Salmond and Sturgeon ran competent governments. Hamza did not. It was a completely incompetent government. No question mark over that. Been interesting if Kate Forbes had, remember, she was only narrowly beaten. If she had become First Minister, would be, you know, where would the SNP be today? But where would the SNP really want to be today if their strategic objective is independence? Now, everybody always wants to be in power, but what I mean is, not those right in the bubble of power, people thinking smartly about the future, another debate. But competent government absolutely brings us on to housing, because in my view, and maybe I've got housing-tinted glasses because of the nature of the work that I do, that you do, there's no question that the handling of housing since Hamza took over has been a significantly incompetent area at a time that everybody recognises that there is, you know, the fashionable word's become a housing emergency, what we'd have called a housing crisis, but there is a housing crisis in every sector of housing, and yet it became one of the most incompetent parts of the government.
And that then, so this is for the listeners where I said I could feed it into housing, that's exactly my perception, that increasingly they were moving away from that. Do not do anything extreme in policy decision making. Don't bring in any bills that are massively out with the mainstream middle ground, wherever that is. And that started to change. And particularly the two big things in the run up to the ending of the Butte agreement appear to be the gender reform stuff, which we won't touch on. No, I don't know anywhere near enough about it. And secondly, housing. And the housing bill, it seemed to be hand in glove with the gender reform stuff as being the two. They were big straws. They were more than straws. They were sticks that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps what we say about gender reform and some of the other issues that have been controversial, and controversial for many SNP MSPs, I respect that, and I don't know enough about the issue either, but from a political perspective, from a very, you know, coldly political, analytical perspective, these essentially are minority issues. And it's not to be disrespectful to minorities. I come from more than one minority. It's not to be disrespectful, but in the grand scheme of things, they would be the straw that broke the camel's back. I suppose that housing is a camel and not a straw, because housing affects everyone. I mean, again, from a political perspective, one of the things that the SNP remarkably done well in the lead up to 2007, secured it in 2012, and I think Nicola took it to a new level, is they won over aspirational Scotland. Mm-hmm. They won over a lot of middle class votes, but certainly those skilled working class, I don't know if these are the terms that people use in politics anymore, but real chunks of that electorate that would otherwise have been generally Labour voters, not entirely incidentally. And they weren't all yes voters. Mm-hmm. And there was lots of people who did not vote yes in the independence referendum from that demographic that then kept voting SNP on the basis of competent government and also just believing that they spoke for aspiration and that they spoke for Scotland. Because that's another important issue, not relevant to housing, but the aspirational aspect is definitely... three failures in housing, in my view. Not recognising that housing, and that includes living in your house and struggling to pay mortgage bills, or making choices about, you know, higher mortgage payments and worrying about what's coming around or not. And I know these are UK macro matters, and there shall be light. I know they're UK macro, but at the end of the day, you have to have something to say to people. And then there's the people with kids that can't get a house. And the answer can't simply be more social and affordable housing. Important as that is, Andy Burnham's made a fantastic announcement today. Important as it is, the answer has to be within every sector. And if you're certainly speaking to that aspirational, who essentially are the swing voters that determine the outcome of elections, that's brutal too. And that's why a lot of people are uncomfortable with Starmer's agenda, but he's trying to win over the people that basically will make the difference on whether you win an election or not. So first of all, not recognising how much that was a core part of the cost of living crisis and the lack of hope among young aspirational people of getting their own home. Secondly, thinking social affordable housing was the only solution, but then cutting the budget by 200 million. And I thought it somewhat ironic that it was cut in order to put money into active travel, an environmental measure, which is very positive and worthy of supporting. But, you know, so with the Greens saying, we want rent controls over here, or we want lots of more social affordable housing, but part of the budget is we want you to put more money into active travel. You know, it shows incompetence in thinking. And thirdly, the housing bill. Now, the housing bill, in summary, in my view, is a dog's breakfast for this reason. Because what it's ended up trying to do in its current initial draft, and listen to what the housing minister says, a man whom I respect as well very much, and I don't believe that he's privately happy with any of this, or that actually speaks for what he believes in. But anyway, what it's now trying to do is keep everybody happy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, once you start doing that in government, your days are numbered, particularly in a moment of crisis. And the housing crisis is significant, it's deep, and it needs some long-term answers, but it needs some very strong decisions from the government. So what we've ended up with is a cut to the affordable housing budgets. There'll be less affordable social houses built. A housing bill that's trying to keep everybody happy keeps nobody happy. As people have said across the industry, it's killed the industry and killed investment coming into Scotland. In many ways, take the issue of rent controls, which is quite controversial. If there'd been a strong position on rent controls, including introducing them, lots of people would have been unhappy. But there are investment funds that would have still invested in Scotland. Industry and the economy and business needs certainty and will work with the ultimate decisions of a democratically elected government. Not everybody, but the point I'm making is, try to keep everybody happy, you kill the industry and kill investment. Now, I can begin to get the impression this was going to be delayed and delayed and delayed, and more consultation, and I kind of hope that it kind of just survives the Green Coalition to the 2026 election. So will we have no investment funds taking Scotland seriously until that time? Or really? So, you know, and then there is the issue about the impact of rent controls and the evidence. And I used to be really strongly in favour of rent controls in principle. Mm-hmm. And then I began to be convinced by the evidence of what it was actually doing, the rent freeze and the rent controls, was ultimately forcing rents up.
Yeah, I mean, so for people, the place in the UK that had the greatest rent increases in the last 12 months have all been in Scotland, particularly around Glasgow and Edinburgh. So the places where rents have gone up most in the whole of the UK in the last 12 months have been the places with the rent controls in place. Because what happens is it makes a landlord between tenancies think to themselves, hold on a minute, I've no idea what I'll be able to do once this tenant's in place. Mm-hmm. So between tenancies, I better whack up the rent. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of future-proofing myself against what's going to happen once the tenant's in place. So that's one of the things that
Patrick
it does.
Patrick Harvey's answer to that, right, to be fair to Patrick, Patrick Harvey's answer to that would be, well, we're going to close that loophole, right? So that you'll be allowed to increase your rent, and you know the draft mm-hmm. proposals, but we'll close that loophole. But here's the consequence of that. PRS, which is a hugely emerging industry, yep. is particularly successful in England, would then not invest in Scotland. And I've spoken to so many involved in this industry south of the border that have told me that, people I trust in their judgment. So, you know, they're part of the solution of the housing crisis, but also you would then continue with this problem of supply and demand within the rent sector. Here's the bottom line truth of economics, and sometimes as a left-leaning person, I don't like this, but, you know, we have to live in reality. You know, science, follow the science, what we're all told. I believe in following science, and I believe in evidence-based things. No living in wish-wish land. I'm just too old for wish-wish land, and the kids in our family don't deserve that either. But here's the harsh reality of economics. The marketplace will always find a way, and if you allow... you mustn't allow an unregulated marketplace, but you cannot put such constraint that you kill a marketplace. But here's the reality, I suppose, that I'm getting to about the private rented sector, institutional private rented sector market. It is not in their interests to have rents that people can't afford.
Yep.
Right? It's just not, because the people won't be able to pay the rent. They need to have a functioning system. They need to have happy tenants and all the rest of it. Actually, the issue is, at the other end of the market, the rogue landlords, who don't care about the 100 people living in a block or 500 or 5,000. And incidentally, remember, institutional PRS investment will be about funds investing in property for 20, 30 years. The idea that they're going to have these high luxury rents that people can't afford is just nuts. And the last point I'm going to make about economic reality, because it relates to housing, of course, but to everything else. See, when you keep adding cost after cost after cost to business, take it into the house building industry, all of the requirements, the contributions that developers and house builders are making, and they should make, right? Mm-hmm. In principle, they should be making contributions. Yep. Everybody should make a contribution in society, but you keep adding and adding and adding. Apart from the fact you chase investment away to where it's less costly to do business. The truth is, when you add these costs on, ultimately the customer pays.
Yep.
So house builders, I don't know if it's the case now, we traditionally have a 20% markup or something. They'll still get their 20%. Even if you ask them to contribute to schools, they'll still get what they want to make out of it. So if somebody has to pay that bill, who is it? It's you and I.
Yeah, it's a purchase.
You know, the consumer will always pay.
And there's so much of what you touch on there that the challenge for me is that there's been a lack of understanding of the wider dynamics of how the economics of everything works. And as you say, you can have your wish list of, I wish it wasn't like that. But the reality is you have to work within it. And one of the things...
To work within it, you get yourself into the centre ground, into the mainstream, so that you can get the best possible compromise on these issues. So you accept that you can't intervene to change the marketplace into the wishlist society we'd all like to live in our hearts, right? You get into a place where you can get some of what you're looking for, and everybody's contributing to a socially responsible society. And that takes us back to the whole competent government. So if we think that we're going to have a more competent government under Swinney of some form, I suppose the question then begins, and they don't have the Greens in coalition, the question begins, what is the implications of all of this? And certainly, and I think this is the point, so I interrupted you, you were about to come to, is that I think we're going to see a more sensible housing bill.
So I was at, the day before the Bute Agreement ended, I was at the Scottish Property Federation annual conference, and poor Paul McLennan, the housing minister, was on, and I think there might have been one person in the room who didn't give him a verbal kicking that day. I felt sorry for him. And he was followed actually by Patrick Harvey, but Patrick Harvey was talking about the sustainability bit, whereas the housing minister was defending the housing bill. And it really, really came across. He couldn't have emphasised it more unless he'd had a neon sign flashing above his head saying, I don't really agree with this housing bill. Because he just kept saying, don't forget, it's just a bill. There's lots and lots of consultation to go through, and everybody in this room will listening to what you're saying, and there'll be changes to it, And I remember sitting there listening, thinking, right, firstly, you don't 100% agree with this bill. Secondly, you know that there's fault in this bill and you want to try and change it. My concern as he was talking was, are we going to end up with a square peg in a round hole of trying to make a bill that doesn't fit, you know, just by chopping off the edges? Now, my gut feel now that that agreement's ended, they will find a way of kicking this housing bill down the road so that actually doesn't make it into statute until, if that's what it's called in Scottish Parliament, until the election, and then they'll be able to change it dramatically after the election, or even pretend that they've got other more important priorities. And the point you make about the financial private companies can work with governmental restraints. What they can't work with is uncertainty. That's what we all saw when the Liz Truss government thing happened. It wasn't what she did per se. It was the uncertainty that what she did created that created the havoc in the market. And if I look back and think back, we had the private rented tenancy. So we had the short assured tenancy came in 1988. And the private rented tenancy comes in roughly 30 years later. So we have 30 years of the same setup, yeah, more or less, in the private rented sector in Scotland. And then we have the private rented tenancy agreement. Then we have the emergency legislation about rent freeze. And now we've got the new housing bill. So if I'm an institution from down south, I'm looking at that going, wait a minute, you had 30 years of pretty even, stable. I knew what was happening in Scottish housing. And now this is your third attempt in 6 years to do something to the private rented sector. So it's not just that this was the third attempt. It would then be in the back of your head, because rental controls were within the PRT legislation that came in 6 years ago, but it was just unworkable. It was rental pressure zones were within it. And always everybody said when the legislation came in, it weren't workable. But if you're an institution down south, you're now looking at that going, wait a minute. They had a crack at it when the PRT legislation came in and it didn't work. Then they had temporary rental legislation came in. Now they're doing another one, and all of it seems a bit rushed. So what are the chances there'll be another piece of legislation after the next Holyrood election, when maybe it's Labour or the majority party? And well, that's the uncertainty that gets them.
Exactly. And I hope that what happens is that under Swinney's leadership is that we see a very sensible housing bill being brought forward now. in whatever way they want to politically manage it, through another round of consultation or whatever. Now, it may upset the Greens, who will not wish to vote for it. And then the pressure will be on the Labour Party. Now, if it's a sensible bill, let's hope that the Labour Party will not play politics and that we can get a bill in place and certainty into the marketplace. And certainty for tenants is important. We want to get to a stage where there are finalised basic rights for tenants, of course, rather than this mishmash, as you say, there's been over the years to try and pull something together, so that whoever wins the next holiday election, we're not back having this debate again. I think actually it would be in the Labour Party's interest to support a moderated, sensible housing bill that's in the another great thing, another great term that is now used on every other issue, the national interest. You know, when I was growing up, being this older man now and all that, my dad, when I was growing up, the national interest, everybody sat up. It was a very important announcement on the BBC generally, but in the national interest, if we can get a starting point that both of our main parties, the Labour Party and the SNP, who speak together for the vast majority of Scotland, right?
Yeah.
They maybe don't speak together as parties and independents and on the union, but they speak together for the vast majority of people that live here, and get to a position that there's a housing bill which the Labour Party can support, then we'll all be able to move on and things will start to improve in housing, not just, you know, for the industry and for the affordable social housing sector, who also were punished terribly during the rent freeze, mishandled rent freeze situation as well, but actually most importantly for the punters, for people.
You mentioned, I mean, one of the challenges in housing, as you say, there's been a focus on, if we're going to solve any housing issues, it's all got to be through the social rented sector, which I sort of do have a bit of sympathy for politicians, because they get, particularly councils and local authority politicians, they get criticised for the lack of council housing. There's so much of that provision now that people would traditionally think of as council housing, in inverted commas, is actually provided by housing associations that politicians can't control. They can do their best by giving them grant money. But I remember, I think I'm far enough away from this incident now to be not telling tales out of school, that to me summed up the challenge of how we've arrived at where we are. And it's the challenge of the nature of politics, I suppose, and everything. It was, I met with two of Scotland's most senior civil servants in the housing world, and this would be about 10 years ago now. And I said, look, we're working with people in the City of London on financing social housing. And in the process of that, I've come up with a way that you can help the social housing providers deliver more housing for the same money. And the two most senior civil servants in Scotland for housing said to me, sorry, Brian, I'm not seeing why we'd want to do that. And I thought, I've obviously worded it wrong. So then changed it to, okay, we can deliver the same housing for less money. And they said the same thing again. I'm not seeing why we want to do that. And then one of them sort of broke ranks and said, look, Brian, this is the situation. We've created a target, a 5-year target of the type of house, of the number of affordable houses we want to achieve. We don't want to blitz that target. And we don't want to not hit the target. We want to just overachieve on that target. Because if we massively overachieve, we'll create a headache for ourselves in the next 5 years, because we've now set this huge target. We want to just hit that target. And I remember saying, but you created that target yourselves. Yes, I know. Well, you must have created it thinking we are going to hit that target. And I realised that part of the challenge here is, this is all part of the electoral game that all political parties play, in that they set a target which sounds reasonably bullish, but not too overachievable, so they can just do it. And it did give me an insight into the challenge we've got of progressing matters, because you've permanently got this, let's hit a target which is ambitious, but not overly ambitious. And then if something changes in our 5-year run up to that target, that means we could blitz it. Don't do it.
No, and the thing is, the great irony of that opportunity and many others where people have had over 20 years of bringing private sector investment in is that we would be in an entirely different position in Scotland in terms of investment in housing, and particularly around social and affordable housing, which in itself would have taken the pressure off the private sector. And again, who would have benefited out of all of this? Because it works both ways. If you add costs and you cause it or do not address a supply and demand issue, ultimately the punter pays. The market will never pay. The punter will always pay. But if you... It works the other way as well. If you solve the problems, prices and costs go down. These are basic economics. I suppose as we draw to a close before the lights go out completely, and we're not a political podcast and all that, but, you know, speculation about people. Will the housing minister survive the reshuffle? Will we have a new housing minister? Who knows? We're told there'll be a slimmed-down government, which I think probably... losses the opportunity which I'd hoped for, which would be to have a cabinet secretary for housing to really recognise this, you know, the level of crisis and emergency around the issue of housing across the country in every sector, every postcode. But surely there's going to be a cabinet secretary with a significant part of their portfolio being housing. That's my prediction. And if I'm wrong, then what I've said about competent government and respect, I mean, we have to take back a little.
Well, you may be right, because I suppose if we've just talked about one of the triggers, one that was certainly in the headlines in the week in the run up to the end of the Bute agreement was housing, then it's maybe an indication that that's one way that John Swinney will show that he's doing things differently. No. So we'll see.
We'll live in hope.
Anyway, thanks, Stephen.
And hope is eternal.
Yes, yeah, so we'll get this out, and then there'll be more. We've got some really good guests already that we've spoken with, and there'll be more coming along soon. Thanks for listening to the Scottish Housing Podcast with Stephen Purcell and me, Brian Gilmore. To ensure you don't miss an episode, please follow us and subscribe wherever you pick up your podcasts. To find out more about the presenters, go to scottishhousingpod.com, and to get all the latest information about forthcoming guests and new episodes, follow us on social media at Scottish Housing Pod.
The Scottish Housing Podcast is brought to you by Indigo Square. Whether you are a landlord looking for a letting agent to help you navigate through all the legislative changes, or a homeowner needing an expert to manage common building repairs. With offices in Glasgow and Ayrshire, Indigo Square are your perfect property partner. Contact us today at indigolets.com.